sheep, as you know. And, well, Dolly the sheep is probably much more important to your and my future lives than whether Tony Blair wins the next election. And I think Dolly the sheep and Max Weber would have had a lot to say to one another. If Dolly the sheep could speak, and no doubt in the future Dolly the sheep will be able to speak. The lights are going out again. God, what a place this is. God, they've gone out completely up there now. So I'll plod on nevertheless. Maybe someone could try and get the lights back on at the top there. Good, well done. Now they're going out down here. That's better. Now they're going out there. Let's strike a balance here. Anyway, Dolly the sheep. What you see in the case of this experiment is massively important conjunction of science and technology with imponderable consequences, truly, for our lives, but plainly will be very consequential for our lives. And this was one of the main areas of interest in which Max Weber, as opposed to Marx, focused. You remember last time, well you may remember last time, I discussed two senses in which Weber talks about the rationalization of modern society and the rationalization of culture. One, the disenchantment of the world. The other, we enter a world of greater design. Modernity is a world which subjects institutions to design, doesn't just inherit them in a traditional fashion. Most sectors of modern societies, Weber argued, become more and more consciously organized or consciously designed. That's two formal senses in which there's an advance in rationalization, but there are two substantive areas of modern institutions, two more concrete areas where rationalization, according to Weber, becomes the keynote motif, the key dynamic. One of these is precisely science and technology. If you remember Marx argued that science and technology provide us with the basis of living a rich and increasingly aspirational life. That is, he saw science and technology as primarily generating wealth. For Weber, this was a naive attitude. The original progenitors of natural science, the original figures who established the natural sciences, Weber says, also believed that science was intrinsically a moral force and a moral force for the good. Most of them believe this. According to Weber, there was even, to some extent, a divine inspiration to this because, as I mentioned last time, for Weber, there was this link between Puritanism and the rise of science. The early scientists thought they were serving God just as the early entrepreneurs did. However, Weber argues, modern civilization is indeed a scientific technological civilization, that's of its essence. But science and technology, Weber says, are much more double-edged and contradictory than the orthodox view of them would suppose. And Weber had a lot of interesting things to say about the marriage of science and technology. It's epitomized, he thought, in the machine. The machine is a routinely organized, regularized way of intervening in nature. Whether it's an industrial machine or electronic machine, for Weber, the machine is one of the prototypical aspects of modern civilization, the rise of the machine. And Weber quite rightly pointed out that the rise of the machine is not confined to peaceful industrial production. It's also applied to warfare. Weber wrote a lot of interesting stuff about war, again, unlike Marx, who didn't take much interest in warfare. And Weber showed that the rise of modern warfare very much bound up with the mechanization of the means of destruction, not just the means of production, but the means of destruction. And there's a sort of interesting terminological thing here, because the machine gun was the kind of marriage of science and technology with destruction about which Weber was talking. The machine gun was first used extensively, I believe, in the American Civil War, and was probably the most destructive form of weaponry around at that time. Significant, it was called the machine gun. Weber argues that a scientific technological civilization can never provide us with values and will always have unintended and unprojected consequences. In both of these senses, he regarded scientific rationalization, the progress of scientific and technological reason, as a much, much more fraught and difficult enterprise than most previous thinkers had argued. Science, Weber argues, and you remember I alluded to this in first time I talked about Max Weber, first lecture I gave about him. Science can never, Weber says, justify values. It's simply logically impossible for any amount of empirical knowledge about the world to show us how to live in the world. Science cannot show us how to live. The original scientists and many of the thinkers of Enlightenment believed that it could, and I think probably many people around today still believe that science in some sense delivers an ethics or delivers moral outlook on the world. But Weber believed, and I think this is broadly speaking correct, it cannot. Science and technology therefore become our way of life, Weber says. The machine enters into so many aspects of what we do. I mean, see people here still writing with pen and paper, but I'm sure lots of people will go to the machine room and will use a computer or word processor to do a lot of their work on. Our world is thoroughly invaded by machine technology. But according to Weber, this is not a world which can show us how to live in respect of the changes that it initiates. So Weber thought that the progress of science and technology actually destroys ethics, that the more social life is governed by scientific and technological innovation, the more morality tends to retreat from those domains of life, and also interestingly the more politics tends to retreat. I'll come back to this later, because I'm going to talk a bit about in this lecture, this is the last one on Max Weber, but talk a bit about his views on politics, which are very interesting too. But Weber believed that science and technology are both depoliticized and demoralized. That is, they're major sources of change in our lives, but they tend to operate outside the political sphere, not themselves be politicized, and they tend to produce changes which alter our lives, but without being guided by an overarching morality. And I think if you see what's going on in the world now with genetic engineering and so forth, you can see that this is true. We live in an era beyond Max Weber, in which science and technology have themselves become globalized. Science is now a global endeavor carried on within global scientific communities. Absolutely nobody controls this process. Therefore, Dolly the sheep is one step along a road to literally no one knows where. But I think you could say, probably without much fear of contradiction, that technological change, scientific and technological change, is probably the most profound source of change in our lives. Knocks lots of things down, doesn't really fit within the political sphere, but it does, in a sense, invade most of what we do. As I'll be talking about in the lectures next term, very interesting and important is something Weber didn't really talk about, the invasion by science and technology of the body. The body is no longer for us something given. The body is just routinely embroiled in scientific, technological, medical, dietary findings. Very, very important for aspects of our lives today. Anyway, Weber had a good purchase on this. He had an interesting intellectual position on it, which is still, I think, worth taking very, very seriously. which are, in sum, rationalization in one sense is the rationalization of nature, governed by science and technology. This is a machine civilization, which itself, in some ways, as I go on to mention, resembles a machine. Science and technology are therefore, for Weber, both the kind of exemplar and the one of the main driving forces of modern civilization, but absolutely towards an unknown future. Science and technology do not simply yield control over the world, they inevitably bring in their train consequences which probably nobody ever predicted. And Weber argues that science and technology are mostly specialist endeavors. This is very important because scientific and technological advance is worked upon by specialists in a particular area. Those specialists normally have no control or even knowledge about the more general applications of what they do. Very clear in the case of Dolly the sheep, where you have a genetic team, as it were, working on a particular area. They produce consequences and results, but those results are very generalizable. The consequences go way, way beyond the work of the technical expert. For Weber, therefore, one of the key figures in modern civilization is the technical expert. But the technical expert is not just like a witch doctor, because the technical expert is really simply a specialist in a diversity of knowledge areas which constitute modern civilization. Modern civilization is like a rolling body of knowledge, as it were. It's not a static relationship to the outer world. It's a continually in flux in terms of its knowledge environment. It's a society dominated by expertise. You cannot live in modern society, Weber says, without relation to expertise of all sorts. So the scientific and technological expert is one figure. Rationalization of science and technology, one driving force. There is a second one, though. The second driving force is the rationalization of social life itself. The rationalization of the machine, control of nature, is complemented by the rationalization of social relationships in the form of the organizations which tend to dominate the modern world. And Weber referred to this as the development of bureaucracy. And he linked the rise of bureaucracy to the rise of organizations in the modern world. Weber's student, Robert Michels, was a political theorist, a student of Weber's, invented this famous phrase, "Who says modernity says organization." The rise of modern society means the rise of large-scale organization. Large-scale organization, in turn, means you must rationally organize human social relationships. The rational organization of human social relationships means the rise of bureaucracy. Now, Weber often compares the rise of bureaucracy to the machine. He talks of bureaucracy as a social machine. So it's very much the complement of the physical machine as an exemplar of these two aspects of the rationalization of modern social life. Let's do very briefly what Weber has to say about bureaucracy, because it was a very big theme in his writing. It's very important. In modern societies, you get the rise of large-scale organizations. Large-scale organizations tend to dominate our lives. Large-scale organizations necessarily have a different form, a different structure from smaller, more traditional ones, Weber says. First of all, a bureaucratic organization is hierarchical, involves a hierarchy of offices. Second, the key figure in a bureaucracy is the official. Bureaucracy means the role of officials. Third, officials are salaried. It doesn't sound very important, but for Weber it's very important. And fourth, in bureaucracy, I'll come back to them in a second. People lose control of what Weber called the means of administration. I'll explain all these things immediately. The best way to see what Weber was talking about when he characterized modern institutions as stamped by the rise of the rationalization of social life or bureaucracy is to compare a pre-modern organization with a modern one. A good example to take is an example of the military, about which, as I said, Weber wrote quite a lot. If you look at a pre-modern army, you find a pre-modern army did not form, as it were, a pyramid like a bureaucracy does. Bureaucratic organization, like a university or like a hospital or like a civil service organization, is a hierarchy of offices with specific duties established for the people who are in those offices. Traditional armies were never like that. Traditional armies were sort of inchoate aggregations of people. The king would go out, he would gather the peasantry would arm themselves, and they'd all gallop off to kill other people. They'd all gallop off to wage war on others. There's no clear-cut command structure in a traditional organization, but bureaucratic organizations have a very clear system of authority. They freeze authority, if you like. That's what gives them their form. For Weber, in this process, rules are very important. There are normally written rules in organizations. This second thing is very, very important, because the complement to the scientific and technical expert in Weber's writing is the official. Modern society is also dominated by the rise of the faceless official. The person you see when you buy a ticket at a railway station, the person you see when you get your dole money, the person you see when you want to change your driving license. Modern organizations are largely governed by officials. What is an official? Well, an official is someone who carries out a certain range of prescribed duties and is not interested in you as an individual. Basic aspect of modern society, as Weber thought, is that many of our relationships are impersonal with other people. You simply play a role as an official and as a client. You have no direct personal relationship to the other individual in most systems where you encounter officials. Very different from, go back to the example of a traditional army, very different from a family too, where relationships are personalized. If you've read Shakespeare, if you've read historical accounts of royal households, they were mostly run through personal connections. What was important is whether you had the eye of the king. There were no specified levels of official duty. The counterpart to the official in the army is the officer. The officer, obviously the term officer, has the same root as official. It means someone in a particular grade, and that has the same root as bureaucrat. They all mean the same thing. In each case, the idea of an office is crucial. Now, as you see in a minute, for Weber, there were big, big problems for modern society given the rise of officialdom. Problems for democracy, problems for control of our lives. The faceless official, Weber feared more, I think, than the scientific technical expert. In this sense, Weber's writing on bureaucracy shares quite a lot with Franz Kafka's account of bureaucracy in his novels, with George Orwell's account of 1984, a society in which officials run rampant. And perhaps in a way reached its apogee in Nazism, where the people running extermination camps famously said, "I am only doing my duty, I'm only doing my duty. Somebody else gave me the orders." Millions of people were exterminated bureaucratically in this sense. You could say this in a sense was the most devastating example of the impersonal role of the official. No one takes responsibility because it's always passed up the system. I was only doing my duty. As you'll probably know, the famous political scientist of somewhat later generation, Hannah Arendt, called this the banality of evil. The banality of evil was the actions of people like Eichmann, who simply said, I'm an official, I'm doing my duty, don't blame me. Don't blame me. The same thing applies in many situations of war, incidentally. Interesting stuff about the people who dropped the first nuclear weapons. Also, initially just mobilized by their distance from the people they dropped them on. They were simply doing their duty. But several of the people involved subsequently had a kind of horrific recantation, reinterpretation of their lives when they realized what they had done. Anyway, for Weber, the idea of only doing your duty is a sort of basic idea of modern civilization. It has many implications. Most officials are irresponsible in the sense in which they're not hooked into a democratic system, Weber thought. Why is it important that they're salaried? Well, it's crucial, Weber thought. It's one of the main differences between modern style organization and traditional organization. Traditional organizations were largely what Weber sometimes calls fiefdoms. Now, if you'll forgive, well, you wanted difficult terms. Here's a difficult term. Prebendal organizations, Prebendal. Which meant essentially in most organizations in the traditional world, you got paid by what you could extract from your position. So, for example, there are some quasi-bureaucratic systems in the traditional world. For example, there was a kind of rudimentary bureaucracy in traditional China, traditional Chinese civil service. How were traditional Chinese civil servants paid? Well, they only paid a very, very low salary. They got most of their rewards from the taxation opportunities they could exploit in their position. The same thing with traditional armies. There was no pay structure in traditional armies. You didn't have an officer who'd get a particular salary like you did now. You would get your reward from whatever booty you could accumulate, from whatever material goods you could accumulate as you carried on the process of war. That's why marauding armies in traditional times used to strip bare, like ants, the territory across which they marched, because their reward was the goods and the wealth they could accumulate precisely through war. Now, for Weber, the advent of the salaried official is so important because with it arises the distinction between behaving properly and behaving corruptly. Weber argues, and I think this is right, there was no notion of corruption in the traditional world. Corruption was simply the way in which things were done. You simply did exploit your position to get whatever rewards you could. We think of corruption as something very, very important, but only because the idea of corruption arises with the idea of bureaucracy, of doing what you're supposed to do as an official and simply getting a salary for it. You are a paid official. That specifies what your role is. Corruption is when you use that role to get rewards which are not specified within the rules of the organization. Why is this important? Well, it's important, Weber thought, because it leaks out all over the place. There's a continuing conflict, really, between the bureaucratic rules of impersonal procedure and the tendency of people to use offices for their own private profit or for other exploitative purposes. You see this tension whenever you read of a Western company covertly having a slush fund, for example, when they do business in certain countries abroad where these practices, Western practices, are not really established. It is simply the way in which you do business in those cultures. You couldn't do business without such a thing. For us, it's a slush fund, it's a form of corruption. You see it everywhere in politics now. corruption cases in countries across the world. Corruption here means the exploitation of office illegitimately, to do, in fact, what politicians for hundreds of years have always done with that office. Corruption, therefore, is the other face of bureaucratic routine and is only invented by the very advent of bureaucracy itself. The fourth characteristic, expressed a bit more clumsily, also very important for Weber, because Weber argues that since organizations, bureaucratic organizations, are hierarchical, basically power becomes concentrated at the top. Bureaucratic organizations, whether they be hospitals, whether they be universities, whether they be schools, whether they be prisons, whether they be business organizations, whether they become government organizations, power concentrates at the top, at the apex of the pyramid of authority. And both those working lower down in the organization and those affected by organizations in their day-to-day lives tend to lose power. The progress of bureaucratic reason is also a process of loss of power, loss of spontaneity, loss of control over one's life for the majority of people, both inside and outside bureaucratic systems. Again, the person I mentioned just now, Robert Michels, Weber's student, had a famous phrase for this. He called this the iron law of oligarchy. Iron law of oligarchy. When you have a large-scale organization, there is no way, Michels says, and Weber says the same thing, in which it can be democratic. Bureaucracy means concentration of power. Weber used this to analyze various kinds of organizations in his own lifetime in a very interesting way. For example, in politics, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, at Weber's time there was the rise of the first mass socialist party, the Social Democratic Party, or SPD. Now the SPD, like any socialist party, is of course geared to democracy. It's supposed to represent the workers, and it's supposed to be a democratic form of involvement in politics. However, Weber and Michels showed that the SPD, in fact, tended to be run by a small elite of full-time politicians. The SPD became what Weber called a party machine. The SPD, therefore, as it became more and more successful, actually subverted its own ideology of democratic involvement. Weber thought this is just a necessity in modern politics. In modern politics, if you're going to win elections, you must regularize, you must have a party machine, you must have, like the Labour Party has at Milbank, you must have a clear system of authority. The more you do this, the more you subvert the very ideals to which the party was established. Weber also studied this leakage of power towards the top within union organizations, or at least mentions this. Other people studied it in more detail later. Labor unions are supposed to represent the mass of workers on the shop floor, but labor unions become bureaucracies. They become dominated by full-time salaried officials. These salaried officials, Weber pointed out, tend to lose contact with the very workforce whom they are supposedly representing. They have their own interests as officials within the organization. They are no longer workers, and those at the top tend to dominate the union organization, and thereby you get major gaps opening up between, as it were, the shop floor and the union. At a later date, this was studied by the American political scientist Seymour Martin Lipset, who with others wrote a book called Union, I think it was called Union Bureaucracy, something like that anyway, which traced out how this happens in large unions. Large unions become bureaucratic organizations like others. Notice how important this is, because every organization is supposedly set up to serve a clientele. Almost every organization, perhaps apart from an army, is set up to do this. A hospital, for example, is set up to do this. Yet hospitals, the larger the hospital, like say Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, was a merger of several hospitals, the more removed, one can argue, the administrative staff and the medical staff are from the patients. Patients become, as it were, categories within the large-scale organization. You could say the same thing is true of large schools, of large prisons, of other organizations. They don't in any systematic way, according to Weber anyway, represent the interests of those they were supposedly set up purposefully to represent. And there's a big, big dilemma, Weber thinks, here in modern politics. I'll come back to that in a second. Weber argued that bureaucratic authority, which he also, also sometimes called rational legal authority because it's based on formal rules, rational legal authority is the same as bureaucratic authority. This is only one type of organization system or authority system you find in history. It is the type of modernity. This is the kind of system of authority which dominates modernity in all spheres of life, Weber thought. Bureaucratization tends to become dominant. In history, however, you find two other kinds of association or organization. You find what Weber simply called traditional organizations. Traditional organizations would be like the example I just mentioned, the pre-modern army, or even in modern society, the family, or in traditional society, the royal household. Non-bureaucratized organizations, by and large. More interesting than this is the third type of authority which Weber distinguished. It's important for his account of modern politics, and it's become very, very influential in general. This is what Weber called charismatic authority. He spoke of the role of charisma, and he spoke of the role of the charismatic leader. For Weber, the progress of history looks something like this. In traditional societies, dominated by traditional organizations, obviously. Modern societies dominated by bureaucratic organizations. These are both forms of what Weber called routinization. They're both ways of living a routine kind of life. However, at certain periods, certain times, for different reasons, routine is broken through. Routine is cast aside and challenged, specifically by charismatic movements and by charismatic leaders. For Weber, charismatic movements are the kind of true, purposeful, moving forces of revolutionary change. Charisma, the term charisma, which Weber was the first to popularize, literally means gift of grace. It means a gift from God. Weber meant by charisma something to do with leadership. A charismatic individual is someone who has emotional presence, who can generate a followership, who are attached to him or her because of their emotional attachment to the leader figure. Charisma means the ability of leaders to stimulate emotional adherence among large numbers of people. So you could say John F. Kennedy had charisma. You could even, according to Weber, say that some of the most noxious leaders in history, like Hitler, for example, was a charismatic leader. Religious figures, of course, were charismatic leaders. Christ was a charismatic leader. Luther was a charismatic leader. Very interestingly for the history of 20th century Marxism, postdates Weber's use of the term, but the 20th century, most Marxist movements have had charismatic leaders. You've had Stalin, you've had Lenin, you've had Mao, you've had Castro. had Tito. There's barely a communist revolutionary movement of the 20th century which does not have a charismatic figure. Weber says, with all social movements, there is always the problem of what happens after the charismatic leader dies or is replaced. Then you get a reversion to routine. Then you get a reversion either to a traditional or a bureaucratic organization. Charisma is unstable. Charisma is not a principle of continuing life. It's a principle of the interruption of routine. It's dynamic because charismatic leaders can generate followerships which, as it were, will go anywhere. They'll go anywhere in relation to the existing system. They'll simply reinterpret things and try and change the world anew. But they are powerful mobile forces. You can easily identify charisma among political leaders. I would say probably also pretty easily identify non-charisma, and you could say, I won't offend anybody, John Major is a prototype of a non-charismatic leader, and whatever other qualities he has. I suppose you say Blair has a bit more charisma maybe than John Major has. Now, Weber thought charisma is important in modern politics in a way I'll come on to mention, but for him it's also fundamental force of history in the way it's just emphasized. And the term charisma, since Weber, has gone, of course, into popular discourse. You find many newspapers the term charisma being used, or charismatic individual. But Weber basically invented this terminology. Now, let's look what Weber has to say about modern politics, because it's also very, very important that it involves all these notions, really. Weber was a critic of Marx in respect of the modern political system. Unlike Marx, he was much more pessimistic about the possibilities of modern politics. He was a critic of socialism. He believed that socialism must fail. And one could say also in this he was right. It did fail, and it did seem to fail for some of the reasons that Weber actually believed it would, both socialism and communism. Let's quickly look at these reasons. Contrast to Marx, Weber believes that there is an inherent tension between bureaucracy and democracy in the political sphere. There is no way of resolving that tension. All you can do is accommodate to it. You cannot have participatory democracy. You cannot have democracy which involves everybody. All you can do is to vote periodically for those who lead you. Weber thought this was important, although nowhere near as embracing as Marx had hoped. It's important, Weber says, the importance of democracy is that it allows you to get rid of leaders you don't like. What modern mass democracy cannot do is give you a say. It cannot give you control over the politicians who influence your life. What it can do is allow you to get rid of them. Although he thought the progress of democracy was limited, Weber thought this was important. And you can see it was important if you look at what happened in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, where essentially you couldn't get rid of the leadership, where there was always a succession problem. And succession was always handled bureaucratically within the Politburo. So Weber thought democracy was limited, but it did allow you to get rid of leaders. This was a significant thing. He thought much the same of capitalism, market capitalism. Market capitalism, Weber thought, is a very limited system. It denies spontaneity in life just like bureaucracy does. It produces a commodified society. Weber argued that in a capitalized bureaucratic state, most of our freedoms come from outside the sphere of the market and the bureaucratic organization. Freedom retreats, spontaneity retreats to the personal spheres of life and to a certain charismatic involvement with leadership. Why, you know, if you're a Weberian, you might ask, why are pop songs preoccupied with love? Weber's answer would be because it's only in the personal sphere that in modern civilization we can discover some spontaneity and control over our lives. It's only in that kind of sphere. In the bureaucratic sphere, you can't, and in the capitalistic market, you can't, and these dominate most areas of your lives. You don't have many songs about either bureaucracy or capitalism, or no doubt there are a few. This having been said, just like democracy, Weber thought that capitalism had certain advantages, and therefore it would be better to preserve it. The most important advantage is just like parliamentary politics, it gives you minimal choice, but it does give you some choice. If you can choose between two brands of a product, or you can make market choices, Weber thought this was a real freedom, unlike Marx, I think. So you put these two things together, Weber's picture of a bureaucratized, liberal democratic, capitalistic state is one of a world where we're all like cogs in a machine, basically, where we're for the most part driven around by forces which we don't fully control, but where certain minimal freedoms are nevertheless possible. These being the minimal freedoms of democratic voting rights and of economic rights in the marketplace, consumer rights, if you like. Weber was a critic of socialism. Weber thought the goals of socialism were the unrealizable. He was a fierce critic of any form of revolutionary socialism or revolutionary Marxism in his time. And he had a clear reason for this hostility, a reason which follows from the two points I've just described. Even if it's true that in a capitalistic, bureaucratized society, freedom is limited, in a socialist version of industrial society, Weber thought, each of the two freedoms we do have would themselves be lost. In a socialist society, you would only have one political party. The logic of this, supposedly, is to allow the party to represent consensus, as I mentioned in the case of Marx's theory. For Weber, all it would do would be to further the progress of bureaucracy. Weber thought that in a socialist society, you would be talking about the rule of officialdom. Political officials would rule us. Those political officials would not be, in any significant sense, electable. Therefore, even the relatively minimal powers of democratic involvement we have with a liberal democratic state would be lost. The same thing, he thought, would be true in the economy. The logic of socialism is a planned economy in which production will be geared to human need. The true outcome, Weber thought, would be simply, again, bureaucratization of economic life, in which consumer power would not be there, and in which, again, the rule of the official would be further substantiated. Socialist society for Weber is therefore an undesirable outcome. He thought that socialism was quite likely, even though undesirable. He lived to see the Russian Revolution, and he wrote a couple of articles on Russia. You can see these translated in the book called The Russian Revolutions. He wrote about 1905 and 1917, revolutionary uprisings, in which Weber predicts the history of communism will be the history of rule by what he calls the petty bourgeois official. The petty bourgeois official. By this he meant the most kind of brutal official, I think, the kind of most petty-minded official would dominate in a socialist society. Some would say he was right about this, but I think things are actually more complicated than that. But he did have some kind of anticipation of what the rise of the Soviet Union, I think, would bring about. There's one element, Weber thought, which can, to some extent, free us from, temporarily, from the limitations of politics, and that is by accommodating politics systematically to charisma. Weber wrote specifically about what he called leadership democracy. Leadership democracy. in which the role of charisma, he argued, would be basic. He built this around a model of American politics and tried to generalize it to other political systems. Weber argued that a presidential election, separate from cabinet government, allows for greater leverage in politics because it allows for charismatic leaders to come to the fore. If you have a system like the British one, Weber thought, you would very rarely get charismatic leaders. You'd have a progression, as it were, from Attlee through to John Major, and you could argue there's some substance in non-charisma in this. You may accept, I don't know, Margaret Thatcher, according to your political point of view, perhaps, but Weber thought in this system you would not get bold, innovative leaders. Bureaucracy is the enemy of innovation, Weber thought. To generate appropriate leadership, therefore, you should have a separate franchise, and this is what Weber recommended for Germany, that the German Chancellor or President should be elected independently of the Parliament. And this indeed, to some extent, is what happened. Now, there's a very interesting historical twist here, because some people in a later generation writing about Max Weber, particularly the historian Wolfgang Mommsen, in a book called, probably the best book on Weber's political writings, Max Weber and German Politics, suggested that there was a connection between Weber's advocacy of leadership democracy and the rise of Hitlerism in Germany. Mommsen argued that what Weber had done is to elevate a system which advocated personal leadership, heroism, a situation in which one individual could come to occupy a prime place in political life. And this, Mommsen argued, to some extent, had actually had a direct influence on the rise of National Socialist thinking in Germany, and therefore an indirect influence on the rise of Hitler. That debate is still continuing. Many more sympathetic followers of Weber, very hostile to that interpretation. Very briefly, just to conclude with, what are the pluses and minuses of Weber's writings? Let me mention these very, very quickly, just to finish off with. Weber was right, I think, about a range of things, and right about some things about which Marx was wrong. Weber was right, I think, to say that history has no form, that history is about the organization of time, it's about how you write about time and how you think about time, and it's about its relationship to the particular civilization which defines time in that way. He was right about that, I think. Second, I think he was right to define a great deal of history thus defined as about power. He was right to stress the significance of power as often the arbiter of the clash of civilizations and the organization of human social life more generally. He was right, I think, to focus on the things I mentioned with Dolly the Sheep right at the beginning, that a great deal of the inspiration of modernity is supplied by its scientific and technological core, that scientific and technological core being both a symbol of modernity, an actual principle of change in respect to the external world, and simultaneously a principle of bureaucratization. Weber was right, I think, in what he argued in areas of his work that I haven't discussed in any detail here, to say that there are many forms of conflict in history, that class conflict is not the ultimate determinant of historical transformation. Weber argued rightly that struggles between men and women, struggles between ethnic groups, nationalist struggles, cultural struggles cannot simply be reduced to class conflicts. History is a complex mosaic of conflict and accommodation. This is surely correct. However, Weber was also wrong, and it's really important for us, I think, to see that he was wrong in some key theorems of his writings. First, if he was right to emphasize the role of power, he was wrong, I think, to argue that power is an ultimate arbiter. I think Weber was wrong to underestimate the power specifically of democracy, that is, the role of democracy and rational dialogue in transforming at least violent power into discussion, public deliberation. Democracy, after all, is much more important, I think anyway, than Weber believed it to be. Its possibilities are more thoroughgoing than Weber believed. And anyone living at the end of the 20th century can see what a significant transformative force it is. Second, crucially, Weber was wrong to say that the progress of science and the progress of bureaucratic reason imprisons us as cogs in a large, technically organized civilization. This is not the case, I think. Weber, like Orwell, like Kafka, saw the world as becoming like a giant machine. But the world, I don't think, is like that. Late 20th century world, I think more aptly, could be described as a runaway world. Not a world which is clearly organized in terms of the actual dominance of technical reason, but a world in which technical reason and science produce many new unpredictabilities for us, where the world feels more out of control than it does within our control, and where problems of identity become much more important than the problem of being a faceless bureaucrat. This is not a world, I think, in which the official reigns supreme in the way in which Weber argued. Third, Weber's writings about bureaucracy, his writings about organization, do not seem to be correct. Weber argued that bureaucratic organization means loss of power, means a hierarchical system, and Weber argued that bureaucratic organizations are the most efficient of all forms of organization. That's why they triumph, but this does not seem to be the case. Certainly does not seem to be the case in our era, where we see that many kinds of much more flexible, decentered, bottom-up decision-making systems, even though some of these might be partly ideological, are actually more effective in accommodating to a world of transformation than any bureaucratic system could be. Weber's view of the creeping dominance of bureaucracy seems to have been largely overturned. It's the bureaucratic systems of government, it's the bureaucratic systems of industry. In classical areas of bureaucracy, like the civil service itself, you see transformation by quite new ideas of organizational innovation, which look much less like bureaucratic organizations than they do like traditional organizations in Weber's format. What this means is, if you put Weber alongside Marx, Weber picked out, no doubt about it, key aspects of modernity which Marx failed to theorize. But Weber's vision is not simply acceptable as an alternative to Marx. We have to look at what's going on in the modern world in relation to ideas which maybe draw on Marx and Weber, but go well beyond them. Now, I've got, five more lectures to give in this course, one more this term, and in those five lectures, I'll be looking at where we do go, what ideas we can preserve from Marx and Weber, but just where we should go now in a world which looks very different from the world which either of them actually predicted. Thanks very much. See you next week, I hope.